Roy Elroy. Daughter Judy. Jane is right.
When I was a kid growing up in the 1970s, watching shows like The Jetsons, it seemed like space travel was inevitable. We'd already gone to the moon. And by the time I was a grown-up, I figured we'd all be using flying cars and riding in space. But space travel for non-astronauts is still a dream, not like TV and the movies.
There are those who believe that life here began out there, far across the...
In the year 1987, NASA launched the last of America's deep space probes.
I claim this planet in the name of Mars.
The first rule of space travel, kids, is always check out distress beacons.
Houston, we have a problem.
We are getting closer to space, though. Nicholas Schmidl has a fascinating story in this week's New Yorker called Rocket Man, the ace pilot leading Virgin Galactic's quest to make commercial space travel a reality. He joins me now by Skype. Welcome to Midday on WNYC.
Thanks for having me on.
Your story starts out describing the three companies led by three billionaires competing in a modern space race to see who can achieve commercial space travel first. And some of our listeners may know who we're talking about and who these three companies are, but who are they? Give us a little update.
Sure. So the company that I have spent the past 4 years embedded with is Virgin Galactic, which is owned by Richard Branson, the British entrepreneur. I would think the Virgin Galactic's closest direct rival is Blue Origin, which is a commercial space company owned by Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon. And the third company, and arguably the sort of industry leader at this point, the juggernaut of the bunch, is SpaceX, which is Elon Musk's company. And they're the most advanced. They're already doing things that the other two are sort of in an aspirational mode of right now.
Right. But just to, you know, keep us grounded, so to speak, what are the boundaries of space? How high do you have to go officially to be in space?
So interestingly, as U.S. government things go, the U.S. government, there are two different designations. The Air Force will award astronaut wings, or has awarded astronaut wings, to pilots who exceed 50 miles above sea level. NASA, however, and most of the international community recognizes space as 62 miles, which is 100 kilometers above sea level.
So that's how far they're trying to take people.
Exactly. So that is where Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, which are both their space tourism model is both based on achieving suborbital flight, and so they are simply trying to sort of crest officially into space and to come what is in a 10 to 15 minute flight. And well, that is, and so that is, that's the designation of space those two companies are aspiring for.
Yeah, it's, you know, it was a little bit of a letdown when I saw that, honestly, because that's not even the distance between New York City and Montauk. That's like, you know, 50, 60 miles. That's space.
Well, the thing is that, you know, you get above, so Virgin Galactic back in April flew its first rocket-powered flight since it suffered a tragic and fatal crash in 2014. And the two pilots were, you know, 84,000 feet above sea level, which is about three times what commercial passenger lines will sort of are traveling at. Right. And at that point, you're still looking down on a sort of a bright blue Earth, and it's black up, you know,
yeah,
above you, et cetera.
It's still pretty far.
Yeah, it's still high and dark.
Okay. Yeah. So who's winning the race, or the suborbital space race?
Well, it's a great question, because what I have been inside of Virgin Galactic for 4 years, so I have a sense of sort of where they are and sort of what their next steps are. I don't know what what Blue Origin is sort of planning to do next. They have, I will say, Blue Origin has on several occasions now with their vertical launch platform, a vertical launch rocket system, They have gone to space, but only with a mannequin aboard, not with a human. Whereas right. Virgin Galactic, they have two pilots on the vehicle. It's much more of a kind of a Buck Rogers like, you know, it looks like it's a rocket ship. It's a spaceship more than it is kind of an up and down sort of rocket configuration, vertical configuration. And so they are, you know, they're probably one or two flights away from making a space bid. And so it's hard to know kind of at what point. And it's also hard to know. The big question is, when do you get to a point when you can start actually fulfilling and flying commercial, taking commercial passengers up?
Right. And we're not there yet.
Yeah, exactly.
The guy you focus on, the pilot you focus on, Mark Stuckey, can you describe him for us? Because he sounds like such a character.
He is the sort of ultimate test pilot in the sense that, you know, he is a legend in the test pilot community. He spent more than a decade as a Marine fighter pilot and test pilot, and then several years as a NASA test pilot, not an astronaut, and then several years as an Air Force test pilot. Had always dreamed of being an astronaut, had been told at a very early age by his father, when he expressed, he watched the John Glenn's first orbital flight with his father, and he told his father that that's what he wanted to do, he wanted to become an astronaut, so as a three-year-old kid. And his dad said to him, his dad was a conscientious objector, and he said, and a Mennonite, and said to him, you know, the only problem is that all astronauts have to, you know, serve in the Marines or the military, and no son of mine will serve. So, you know, since age three,
he had this thwarted ambition.
Totally. And so that is what he's kind of been pursuing since then.
And now he works for Virgin Galactic.
Now he works for Virgin Galactic, and he is their lead test pilot, and he brings this sort of wealth of experience. I mean, all the test pilots at Virgin Galactic are all former military pilots. All of these guys are legends in their own right. I mean, I'm truly one of the other pilots is a former Marine fighter pilot who had flown combat missions in Iraq with my own father, actually, in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War.
Your
and
father?
Then went on to become. Correct.
Okay, so you have a personal connection here.
Yeah, so there's these my father was served in the Marines for more than 30 years as a fighter pilot and F-18 pilot. So this type, if you will, is a very familiar one. And so all of the pilots of Virgin Galactic are just, I mean, these guys are incredible. And so they it's a very cool thing to watch also, because for all of these pilots, unlike the first generation of test pilots that we all saw in The Right Stuff, the pilots of Virgin Galactic are interestingly sort of at the tail end of their careers rather than sort of at the earlier part of their careers. And so there's this place in Mojave, California, that is just this, it is a sort of magical spot in the middle of the desert, 2 hours north of LA, where there are all these, you know, whip smart young engineers designing spaceships, and these, you know, sort of I don't use weathered in a negative sense, but these, you know, these experienced longtime military test pilots who are out there sort of, this is their sort of last hurrah before they hang up their flight suits, is to make commercial space a reality.
Welcome back. I'm WNYC reporter Beth Fertig. This is Midday, and I've been speaking with New Yorker staff writer Nicholas Schmidl about his recent article, Rocket Man, which looks at Virgin Galactic's bid to compete with others to be the first commercial manned rocket into space. And we've been talking about this place in the Mojave Desert that you just described, Nicholas, where Virgin Galactic is testing the rockets and the manned spacecraft. They actually sent a craft into outer space more than 10 years ago, or maybe near space more than 10 years ago in 2004. But the spacecraft they're working on now is called Spaceship 2. So if they've already done it before, why is it taking them so long to do it again?
That's a great question. So they actually did not. So in 2004, there was a contest that an entrepreneur named Peter Diamandis had offered a $10 million award to the first person who could send a manned spacecraft twice beyond the international recognized boundary of space within 2 weeks, and it was called the XPRIZE. And at that point, kind of wild-eyed, visionary aerospace legend named Burt Rutan designed this vehicle called Spaceship One, which was modeled on the X-planes from the 50s and 60s that the Air Force and NASA were flying. And they did successfully fly to space a total of 3 times. Now, Richard Branson was invested in that project, and Richard Branson, after Burt Rutan and Spaceship One, his company is called Scaled Composites. After they sort of proved the concept with a single pilot, Branson said, "This is amazing. I want to develop this. I want to have 2 pilots, 6 passengers, larger space, and a larger vehicle." And so they have essentially been trying to scale what was a proven prototype in 2004. But flying a prototype with 1 test pilot was an incredible feat that they accomplished. But what Virgin Galactic is trying to do is to prove that you can do that, not kill everyone on board, and do it every week for years and years and years at
which
a time.
Is super
they're sort of, totally. I mean, it's you know, they're settling for sort of nothing less than almost, you know, airline standards of safety in something that has historically, as NASA has found out through a couple of accidents of its own, is no easy task. So that's really the engineering challenge that Virgin Galactic is trying
and Branson,
to do right now.
Branson was hyping this for so many years, you know, and it's still taking a long time. And then his competitor, Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, shot a rocket into space in 2016. There wasn't anybody on it, but, you know, not a real person. They managed to bring it successfully back down to Earth. You may remember those YouTube videos that were pretty incredible. And when you watch them, the SpaceX rockets look exactly like a NASA rocket. They're these long rocket ships standing upright on the ground. They go vertically. Virgin's got a different approach, though. As you described, it's more like a commercial plane, but not really a plane. What's the difference between how they're going to get to space?
Yeah, great. So exactly. So what Virgin Galactic is doing is that they have this sort of they have a spacecraft. It looks like a regular sort of a sleek airplane looking vehicle, and it attaches to a mothership, a dual fuselaged sort of a wide wingspan mothership called White Knight 2.
It can't go on its own. It has to be lifted.
That's correct. Well, Spaceship 2, that's correct. It cannot take off on its own. And so it gets towed up to about 45,000 feet. And then at 45,000 feet, the 2 pilots inside of Spaceship 2 command release. The pilot of the White Knight 2 of the mothership drops the spaceship. The spaceship begins to fall away from White Knight 2, and then the pilots light the rocket. And from there at 45,000 feet, it enters what they call the gamma turn. So it goes from a horizontal flight pattern to a almost 90-degree vertical flight pattern within a matter of seconds, and that is how they then ascend. So it's a phenomenal thing to watch. I watched one of these flights, the one in April, and it's just, I mean, from the ground, it is a truly stunning thing to watch.
So it's like this giant bird carrying another bird? How big is the mothership?
It has the White Knight 2 has a wingspan of 140 feet. Yeah, it's very much a kind of a marsupial looking configuration.
And then the spaceship itself?
Spaceship is 60 feet long, and there are two pilots in the front, seats for 6 passengers behind that, and then behind the passengers is where the main oxidizer tank, which is where all the nitrous oxide is stored, which oxidizes and the hybrid rocket motor system in the back. And so one of the things that's also different about the rocket motor that Virgin Galactic uses is that with this hybrid configuration, they are able part of the rationale for using this is that the pilot, at any time that they feel something is going wrong, they can shut off a valve that stops the combustion process. And so it offers a very much a fail safe it's a less complex and more sort of a more safety minded rocket configuration, as much as one can be. I mean, these are still, you know, they're still sort of creating controlled explosions in the back of the vehicle every time they light the rocket. But it's a, you know, truly sort of, you know, man versus physics kind of thing going on.
So the Galactic, Virgin Galactic's model that you're describing is different from Musk's model of the rocket ship, but it's also, you're saying, you know, there's a pilot, and that's Mark Stuckey, who's the guy that you're profiling in this New Yorker piece, where he's pushing buttons, pulling levers, controlling this ship as it leaves the atmosphere. But you say the other companies would control the journey to space with computers, which may sound safer or not, depending on how you feel on things like driverless cars. But these pilots, they take such pride in the fact that they're commanding these ships in a way your story wouldn't exist without them, right? I mean, why do you think...
I mean, I think that adds the human element to it, for sure. Yeah, I'm sorry.
So is it a safety factor or is it something else? Like there's a pilot in your ship, you're not just being driven by a computer, or is it really safer, or is it just like more glamorous maybe?
It's a great question. So I mean the technology that Virgin Galactic is expanding upon, and the prototype that they're expanding upon, was one that was developed by test pilots and by aerodynamicists who build airplanes. They don't build rocket ships. So, you know, when Burt Rutan successfully made those space flights in 2004, you know, he was coming, this was his first foray into building spaceships. And so he was coming at it very much from a kind of an airplane design perspective. And so, and part of I think the appeal of what Spaceship Two offers, I mean, you're right, when you introduce humans into the picture, it does add a level of potential fallibility, which is something that something that Virgin Galactic and its main subcontractor, who was flying, who was sort of in control of the flight test program at the time of the 2014 crash, discovered, which is that, you know, humans make mistakes, and even exceptional pilots make mistakes. So there is an element that excellent pilots can anticipate things that maybe computers cannot. There is also, undoubtedly, as you mentioned, there is also just this level of glamour may not be necessarily the right word, but there's a human element to this story that I sort of, you know, that is not quite as apparent with Blue Origin, with SpaceX.
And that's what drew you in.
Those stories are, right, those stories are more sort of engineering feats, and these are more, I think, stories of sort of tremendous courage and bravery, as well as engineering marvels.
So Mark Stuckey, this pilot that you profile, he's piloting the spaceship. You describe it so vividly. They go up, they're attached to the mothership, and then their spaceship is dropped. They fire the engine. They're going really, really fast. I know you couldn't be in there with them, but you describe it so vividly. What happens as their spaceship is released?
So the spaceship is released, then the pilot, whoever the pilot is, and, you know, Mark Stuckey is one of seven pilots they have at the company. There's a former British Royal Air Force pilot, two former U.S. Air Force pilots. It's a totally distinguished cast. And so after the pilot commands for them to fire the rocket motor, they do that. Now, the rocket motor, they've calculated it, in order to get them to space, this rocket motor would need to burn for approximately 60 seconds. And so they have had seven at this point rocket-powered flights. The first three were flown for 16, 20, and 20 seconds. And you know, that kind of just begins to get you into that vertical configuration, that sort of vertical gamma turn that I described. Mm-hmm. The fourth one, it was the one that ended tragically with the crash. The fifth one was the one that I witnessed. So after they begin that vertical turn, they are adjusting the nose attitude, and then once they crest at the top of the apogee, whatever that is, depending on the duration of the rocket burn on that particular flight, then, you know, up there the air is thinner, the atmosphere is they're leaving the atmosphere, and the spaceship there, they have a few moments of sort of zero G experience up at the top of that turn. And then one of the very unique aspects of this vehicle is what is called the feather. And if you could imagine, the vehicle sort of fold upon itself. It looks like a switchblade up in midair, and the tail booms swivel so that the vehicle falls like a shuttlecock. And that's because there has always been a concern that upon as you're re-entering the atmosphere at high speeds and the air is getting thicker, the chances of the vehicle breaking apart are significant. And so the designer had designed this shuttlecock so that essentially the vehicle would float down in this sort of high drag environment,
like
high
brake.
Drag, low speed environment.
It's sort of like
exactly.
a brake.
It's like a. So, I mean, that's the function for sure.
Okay.
And then once they've fallen, then they glide their way down into a landing strip.
I'm WNYC reporter Beth Ferdig, and I'm speaking with New Yorker staff writer Nicholas Schmidl about his recent article, Rocket Man, which looks at Virgin Galactic's bid to become the first commercial manned spaceship. When you're talking about what this spaceship is doing once it gets into suborbital space, you mentioned, like, you're going at supersonic speed. And there's something that you call transonic. It's a zone where all kinds of weird stuff happens to the ship and the human body. What's happening there? What happens to the human who's riding this thing?
Yeah, so Mach 1, the speed of sound, as the vehicle is approaching Mach 1, from about Mach 0.8 until about Mach 1.1, there is this zone it's called the transonic zone, and it is in some ways a sort of Bermuda Triangle of airspeed. Weird things happen as vehicles are passing through this zone, and in most modern,
well, we remember the Concorde would pass the speed of sound. So,
right.
That's so Mach. Mach is is when you hit the speed of sound, and so
Mach 1 is correct.
The numbers refer to, like, little shout out to Battlestar Galactica fans. Remember, faster than light. You know, everything was measured by how many faster than light speeds they were going. So it's the same thing with sonic. When you pass the speed of sound.
Yes. Yeah, so light speed is all the sort of Mach numbers are corresponding to speed of sound, not to speed of light. But
right.
Mach 1 is the speed of sound. Mach 2, twice the speed of sound.
Right.
The Virgin Galactic vehicle will eventually has reached, I think, just at the cusp of Mach 2. But Spaceship 2, which did go to space, was up at Mach 3. I mean, I'll just note that. It one of the incredible things to think about is that for a vehicle, the speed at which which objects are traveling around the Earth in orbit is Mach 25.
Whoa!
And while you don't feel that as much because the atmosphere is thinner, it's not eight times more intense than Mach 3 necessarily. But for the space shuttle, for instance, for NASA space shuttle or any vehicle to enter orbit, you need to be traveling at Mach 25, which is a crazy thing. But
if you're on this commercial, this soon-to-be commercial or aspiring commercial spacecraft, what's it going to feel like? I know you couldn't be on it. Nobody has yet, except for the pilots. But do you vomit? You know, you describe at one point they're going to have little doggy bags, you know, little wipes for people when they ride it.
Well, this is the sort of second challenge, which is what Virgin Galactic is working through right now, which is that the development program is very much the unknown. You're figuring out sort of what stresses and pressures the pilots are feeling and what stresses and pressures the passengers are feeling. Before they put passengers on that spaceship, they will sort of ensure that this is an enjoyable ride. And then the pilots have said that actually, you know, so I went and spent a few days with the pilots in a centrifuge, which sort of whips you around at, you know, I think the centrifuge travels at 60 miles an hour. It's this big steel configuration with a 25-foot arm and a capsule on the end, and it just whips you around. I mean, it's a crazy roller coaster ride. And it's disorienting because you're experiencing all the Gs, all the gravitational forces. But you're experiencing them sideways because in order for you to be able to feel the G's as you're spinning sideways, you have to tip the capsule, you have to tip it on its side. So I went and did this with the pilot for a few days, and, you know, it's intense. And there's a little bit of sort of borderline, you know, euphoria for those who do this on a regular basis as you're feeling those sort of gravitational mm-hmm. forces, you know, and you're feeling the blood flowing in and out to and from your brain. But what they've done with the Virgin Galactic for the passengers already is they've designed seats that will tilt in a way that will sort of redirect some of the more significant and intense G-forces.
So it won't be that uncomfortable.
That's what they're working through. But the pilots also say that that rocket flight, it feels like you're sitting on a magic carpet ride. It's very smooth. It's not sort of nearly as intense as even the training that they're doing.
Right, but it's still dangerous. And, you know, you really go into that in your profile because there is a human cost. I mean, we remember the Space Shuttle Challenger exploding in the 1980s, and you talk about the risks and how Mark Stuckey, the pilot, he even wrote his own obituary in 2007. And that same year, three people at Scaled Composites, which was contracted by Virgin Galactic to build their engines, three people were killed when a fuel tank exploded. And later, Stuckey's co-pilot and best friend is killed in a tragic accident. You know, how dangerous is this?
I think that test pilot, you know, conducting flight tests on supersonic vehicles that are trying to go to space is inherently a very dangerous job. And there, you know, the 2007, you know, when he wrote his obituary, that was, he was in the Air Force at that point and doing, you know, working on a classified project. And so that was sort of a different basket of risks altogether. But, and the 2007 accident was related to, you know, that was more of a rocket motor malfunction. But you're right. I mean, all of these technologies come with tremendous risks. And that, I think, again, you know, just to stress, that's the big engineering hurdle and obstacle that Virgin Galactic is trying to manage right now, which is, how do you, once we've mastered all of this and once these elite test pilots have proven the concept, how do we ensure that it is going to be 99.999% safe for the you know, to put passengers on there?
And you describe all the checks that they do with, you know, engines, check thrusters, check, you know, all that stuff it's a protocol, and you're using these experienced pilots to make sure that it's going to be as safe as possible. And it seems like you said they've refined it a bit since Stuckey's co-pilot died.
They've made all sorts of change. I mean, in 2014, on Halloween 2014, on what was to be the fourth rocket-powered flight, it broke up in midair, and one of the pilots miraculously survived, mm-hmm. and the other did not. And so the vehicle, the Spaceship Two, the first iteration of Spaceship Two was you know, their wreckage was scattered across the desert. And as they began rebuilding or building another spaceship after that, you know, they asked themselves a number of hard questions, which is that they went through every single system on the vehicle and said, could we make it stronger or safer? Also asking, though, every time you do that, every time that you make it a little bit heavier, it's going to take away from performance. And so there's that balance. Like, the vehicle has to be light enough to be able to go to space. It has to be strong enough to be able to do it, to survive, you know, the gravitational forces, variable enough to do it day in and day out. I mean, there are all these sort of various considerations.
Right. Why isn't NASA doing this? Yeah. Can I just ask, you know, what people, we for many years, all of this was left to NASA. Now it's the private sector. How come?
I think that NASA is focused, I mean, NASA has in public announcements, is focused on deep space exploration.
Research.
And doing sort of deep space research. They are also now, as of next year, NASA astronauts, for the first time since 2011, will be making crewed missions to space, to the International Space Station, aboard American-made rockets, or aboard more specifically aboard SpaceX rockets. For the past seven years, NASA astronauts who are flying to space did so aboard Russian rockets, flying from former territories in the
SpaceX, meaning Elon Musk's?
Elon Musk's company will begin sending NASA astronauts to space in April 2019.
Because we Americans didn't invest in this. The private sector is now enabling NASA to do this instead of relying on the Russians.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, the Russians were charging, according to some Wall Street Journal reporting from earlier this year, the Russians were charging $75 million a seat to NASA to take one NASA astronaut to orbit.
Yikes. I want to, you know, before we wrap up, when we're talking about commercial space travel, it's not going to be for everybody. You know, this is super expensive. I think you said it's $250,000 a ticket that people are paying for in advance before it's even been proven, right?
Correct. Yeah, so that's for a reservation.
So, you know, this is a space race. You're talking about these billionaires, Richard Branson, Elon Musk, and it's not, you know, in a way it feels like the current wars, the electric wars between Edison and Westinghouse, you know, when they were rivaling over whether electricity was going to be AC or DC. But they were building something that was for everybody. It was for all consumers to use, to light their homes, to, you know, run the subways. This is so rarefied. It's not for everybody. So is this just going to be entertainment for the rich, or is there some deeper meaningful plan that's going to come out of this, or aspiration by sending some rich people up into space?
I think there are going to certainly be second and third order effects that are going to be much more widespread. And I think that once, I mean, just looking at mastering suborbital spaceflight, if Virgin Galactic can prove this concept and they can do this safely for 6 passengers, one of the things that Richard Branson has already spoken about is being able to sort of translate that to what they call point-to-point travel, which is that if you could do that, you could take passenger airlines and using rocket technology, be able to take, you know, 150 passengers maybe from New York to Sydney in a matter of hours rather than, you know, what does it take now, 14 or 15 hours. And so I do those sorts of technologies. I mean, again, that's not going to be a cheap airline ticket.
No.
But there is, this is the nature of innovation. It often begins very rarefied. And then, you know, I don't think that this is a purely a vanity project. And I do think that there are broader public effects, many of which we have no idea and no way of anticipating at this point now.
Even if it's just what you call the overview effect, what scientists call that, that you look down at Earth and you get this new perspective. Maybe if a few rich people go up and see that, they're going to want to invest in, I don't know, stopping climate change or working on the issues on Earth when they get a new perspective. Is that what you took out of it?
Just rhetorically, think about the rhetoric emanating from Virgin Galactic and Richard Branson. You know, the notion of the overview effect. You go up to space, you look down, there are no borders, there are no divisions, et cetera. You know, think about that sort of in the same context right now as we're talking. There are discussions about, you know, Space Force, achieving dominance in space vis-a-vis sort of nation states. I mean, those are two very different sort of goals in space. And so I do think that on the commercial side, it is very much more of a kind of a humanistic ambition. And for that, it's, you know, it's inspiring.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Nicholas Schmidl has been talking about his recent article, Rocket Man, in The New Yorker, and his amazing profile of the Virgin Galactic pilot Mark Stuckey as they attempt to become the first commercial flight into space.
Thanks for having me.